Well, I'm very welcome, and I'm very glad to be back with you again today. Everybody, little children, everybody watching today. It is March 22nd, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 16:41 hours Eastern Daylight Time. And it's 16:41 hours, and I've had a bit of a delay today because whenever I have contact with the outside world and try to arrange something, I talk too much and it's hard to get. I don't ask enough questions. I don't get enough information. It's hard to get exactly synchronized with the people with whom I'm about to have a transaction. So I had to wait a little longer today because of that. But it's fine. I'll talk about it later as regards what was involved or what the details were. But for now, let's continue. Let's try and continue our study of the Crucible of Credible Creed, Chapter 9, Paragraph 3 today. And we want to look also at, while we're doing that, and our other readings and studies that we're going to be doing also, I think I'm going to have to find it. Here it is. The Moses Part 2. I wanted to show the table at the end of this, Table 5b, after the kings, after the list of kings for the two different kingdoms, the north and south of Israel. We have explanations of the eclipse and things like that, but also the list of kings. We have the age of the sons, or the age of the father at the son's birth here. So David was 30 when he began to rule. He ruled for 40 and a half years, and his son was a certain age at the time that David stopped being king and his son started being king. So whatever age his son was, Solomon, that is subtracted to get back to the birth of Solomon from the age of David at the end of his reign. So 70 and a half minus the age of Solomon at that time would give the birth year of Solomon, or how many years old David was. So then that age of Solomon is what goes in the next entry, on the next table entry for Solomon. His age plus the number of years he ruled, which is X plus 40. So the X's cancel out when we add these two together, you see. And then the age of Rehoboam was 41, so minus 41. And so X plus 40 minus 41, that's the age of Solomon at his son's birth. We don't know how old Solomon was, though, at the beginning of his reign, so it's X. But then if we add the two for David and Solomon, the X's cancel out because X is minus X subtracted in David's case, and it's a positive number in the case of Solomon, how old he was at the time he started to rule. So all these variables, X and Y here, because we don't know how old Abijam was when he began to rule. He's also called Abijah. But this king, the son of Rehoboam, we don't know his age, so this becomes a variable Y that cancels out when we add those two together. And then the Z, which is the age of Asa when he began to rule, we don't know that either. So it doesn't matter, because those ages cancel out. It doesn't even matter. Even if we did know what it was, it would still cancel out when we added up all these ages, and then we average them by dividing by how many there are, five kings there, from David down to Asa. And that's 26.7 years is the average age of the father at the birth of the son, you see? So that's remarkable. We can do that calculation. And the average years reigned, we can also do that. Averaging the number of years for each of those kings, we get 27.7 in the other column next to the age of the father at the son's birth. So they're both about 27 years. which is absolutely remarkable, or it's important, because that's also what we know to be the age of a father on average at the birth of his firstborn son, even in our day. Very true. Very close to what we know is right. We know enough from the Holy Scriptures, and there are sometimes very rarely exceptions to that. Perhaps if a family is living very sequestered, the fathers might get married at a younger age and have sons at an earlier age. It does happen in France, I think, at some time in history, and maybe even in Egypt a little bit. But it's basically very true that this average of 27 is a very good number, sometimes 28, sometimes 26. You know, you can stretch it to 25. It doesn't usually go down as low as 20 years or 22. That's a questionable number for an average age for a long series of generations. Unless you're going back to the more ancient times, like before Moses and way back, you know, to the time of the patriarchs like Jacob and his father Isaac and his father Abraham. They had children. They lived longer, too, and they had children. Their firstborn son was typically at a much older age for the father. But anyway, counting back from a year which is well established, we can determine David in chronological position from the Holy Scriptures. We believe that. And the year mentioned in the paragraph here is Josiah's death, and wrong by 1 year here, apparently, because later we decided, well, that's not quite right. Daniel Kahn presents an argument. He's a scholar who presents a strong argument that should be 609, not 608. But it's still correct in the sense that it's the end of Josiah's official rule would be 608, because after his death, his rulership officially continues till the end of that calendar year, which ended in the springtime of 608. So Josiah's death in 608, technically, actually, he died, we believe, in 609, and shortly before Nebuchadnezzar II came to rule Babylon, which was in 604 BCE. So from Josiah back to David, we're going to calculate now, there are 17 generations inclusive of kings of Judah whose average age at fatherhood, done using the same method I just showed you, the average age was 26.75 for all 17 generations. So it didn't change much from the example we just gave, the five generations. Very, very similar. So it's more proof. This we computed in Table 5A of the article Moses, right? That was part 2. After I wrote this article, the article Moses was divided into two parts after that. But you would find it in part 2 of the article Moses. I should maybe add that to this article as a make sure that I mention this part 2. This average age is exactly what is expected for firstborn sons who tend to approach 27 years for a male generation. It's astounding, right? That's accurate, because since that is accurate, right? Because that's accurate, because that's so close to what we know it should be, or what we know it typically is, that makes it impossible to question any of the dates or the ages of the kings and how long they ruled in the Bible. It's impossible to question it because this number is verifiable. It's a reputable number. It's a well-known fact of people who calculate statistics that this is something known. The average reign from King David, and you know, because it's over 17 generations, that makes it more certain. Five generations is a short average time, right? A short time to average. But if you get to 10 or 9 or 10 or more generations, then the accuracy and the average becomes more accurate. The accuracy of the calculation increases. Or the accuracy of or the likelihood that it's going to approach this number, 27, increases. The average reign from King David in 1058 to the death of King Josiah, that's a different calculation, not the age of the firstborn, not the age of the father at the birth of his firstborn son. He could have had daughters, too, prior to having a son. That's why the average age is 27, not 22 or whatever, because his firstborn child might be a daughter. But the average reign from King David to Josiah to his death, the average rulership would be the same thing. That's 1058 minus 608 divided by 17. And that is 26.47. I didn't check that. Well, I haven't checked the other one either, but I've checked this so many times, I know that's got to be right. It's got to be right. It has to be correct. It better be right. Minus 608. Or we could even say 609. But I better say 608 if I want to get the same answer. Divided by 17. Okay. 1058 minus 608 divided by 17. 26.47. Exactly what I wrote. And that's very near the average generation of 26.75. So that also validates all of it. Because they succeeded one another, ruling in succession, and each one was the son of the previous king. That's what we would expect exactly to happen. So that's proof also. It's verified, right? As faithful is the holy word vindicated by these numbers. That vindicates the Bible. There is no other way to arrive at this result truthfully. King David, therefore, began to reign very near to 1058 BCE. We need, or may not, be ready to date King David any more precisely, but his date determines the Exodus quite precisely. That's the other thing, because the temple was built in King Solomon's fourth year, 1014 BCE. The Exodus is dated to 1493 BCE, as 1 Kings 6 and 1 relates, quote, the 480th year after the sons of Israel came out of Egypt is Solomon's fourth year, end quote. Okay, there's a paraphrase in there, but it definitely says it was the fourth year of the king. Well, we'd have to check it, I guess. We'd have to go back and check, just to double check it, just to see what the wording is. 1 Kings 6 and 1. Yeah, it came about in the 480th year. Yeah, in the fourth year after Solomon became king over Israel. That's what it says. Okay, so we calculated it as 479 years, right, and some months, which, or some fractional number of days, or I mean, fractional number of months, or it was in the second month that he did it, so it's actually very, just about 1 month and some days, or you know, it's a very short period of time, more than 479 years that we adopted in that calculation to determine the Exodus year. But there's more than that. The Exodus year was lunar aligned also. It's aligned to the lunar calendar because there has to be also, or there, we were told, or it's aligned to the Sabbath, that the lunar calendar day has to fall on a Sabbath for a particular lunar calendar day that was given in the Bible, and that's what we, at the institution of the Sabbath, that's what we used to make sure that that 1493 is the right year. It has to align with the lunar date given, which we talk about in the article Joseph, and we say which date and everything, we consider it all, and that proves that it, we can't flex it, we can't move it around. 1493 is the actual year. That's the only year nearby to when the Sabbath would be in that aligned position. So it proves that that's the Exodus year. At least if we're close to being correct about 1014 being the fourth year of Solomon, which we are based on what we just talked about with these numbers of averages, So we know that 1493 must be the Exodus year. It's proven, or it's very, very likely. It's proven as long as 1014 is certain, then it, 1493 is proven based on lunar considerations that we didn't talk about today. In the 18th year of King Jeroboam, before we read that, it's a lot to cover. I'm sorry. I'm a little bit helter-skelter today just because of the problem that occurred today. It wasn't very bad, but it just put me a little behind schedule relative to where I would have been. But I got a lot of things. You know, there are benefits in that. You know, there are things I got to think about that I wouldn't have thought about, things that are going to help. So it's all good. It's all good. The heart of man, Proverbs 14 and 10, little children, our proverb for today. The heart of a man is of trouble aware, and strangers will not in his joy have a share. Proverbs 14 and 10. How wise is that? Remarkable statement. See, many people will try to share their joy with a stranger because they don't know this. Especially people who are lonely, of course. But the heart of a man is of trouble aware, and strangers will not in his joy have a share. They might have a share in his trouble. In other words, now our reading from 2 Chronicles chapter 13. It's not too long, but it's 22 verses. In the 18th year of King Jeroboam, it was that Abijam, began to reign over Judah. 3 years he reigned in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Micaiah, the daughter of Uriel of Gibeah, and war itself took place between Abijah and Jeroboam. That's Jeroboam was in the northern kingdom of Israel, and Abijah was in the south. He was the son of Rehoboam, right? Now, so Abijah engaged in the war with a military force of 400,000 mighty men of war, chosen men, little children. And Jeroboam himself drew up in battle formation against him with 800,000 chosen men, valiant mighty men. So 400 against 800,000. 400,000 against 800,000. Abijah now rose up upon Mount Zemaraim, which is in the mountainous region of Ephraim, and said, "Hear me, O Jeroboam and all Israel. Is it not for you to know that Jehovah, the God of Israel, himself gave a kingdom to David over Israel to time indefinite, to him and to his sons, by a covenant of salt? And Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, the servant of Solomon, the son of David, proceeded to rise up and rebel against his Lord." In the reference here, there's a reference somewhere. I don't know which one it is now. Is it this one? Yeah. 1 Kings 11 and 40, Solomon began seeking to put Jeroboam to death. So Jeroboam got up and went running off to Egypt to Shishak, the king of Egypt, which also shows that Shishak was ruling Egypt before Rehoboam came to the throne, which means at least 5 years, well, 5 years before he came to Jerusalem in the fifth year of Rehoboam, but also it was at least sometime before the beginning of Rehoboam's rule, which is in our chronology 977. Rehoboam year one, which means that Shishak was ruling Egypt, and the date we have for him, one of the most significant dates we have for his year one, his sole rule, when he began to rule Egypt by himself, Shishak was, Shoshank, as he's also called, this king of Egypt was ruling in 980 in our chronology, so 980 fits well with this discussion of him being ruling Egypt while Solomon was ruling prior to 977 when Solomon died. And his son, Rehoboam, took over the kingship of Israel. So that's worth noting in the chronology, certainly. But Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, the servant of Solomon, the son of David, proceeded to rise up and rebel against his Lord, and that's when he ran down to Egypt after Solomon was threatening to kill him. But he came back, of course, when Solomon died. And idle men, good-for-nothing fellows, kept collecting themselves together by him. Finally, they proved superior to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. When Rehoboam himself happened to be young and faint-hearted, it says here in 2 Chronicles chapter 13, verse 7. Now, Rehoboam was 41 years old when he began to rule, and he's called young and faint-hearted. Right here, that's considered young, 41 years old, and he did not hold his own against them. And now you men are thinking of holding your own against the kingdom of Jehovah in the hand of the sons of David when you are a large crowd? You men are thinking of holding your own against the kingdom of Jehovah in the hand of the sons of David when you are a large crowd and there are with you the golden calves that Jeroboam made for you as gods. Have you not driven out Jehovah's priests, the son of Aaron and the Levites, and do you not keep making priests for yourselves like the peoples of the lands? As for anyone that came and filled his hand with power by means of a young bull and seven rams, he became a priest of what are no gods. As for us, Jehovah is our God. So they had priests from the people, the populace in general, in the northern kingdom. Anyone that could come and bring a young bull and seven rams. As for us, Jehovah is our God, Abijah continued, and we have not left him. But priests are ministering to Jehovah, the sons of Aaron, and also the Levites in the work, and they are making burnt offerings, smoke to Jehovah morning by morning and evening by evening, and also perfumed incense. Well, of course, actually, they weren't serving Jehovah at this point, very likely because they had departed in the days of Rehoboam. Hopefully, you would hope they would be, but they would be serving Jehovah. And they were making perfumed incense to smoke as one of the services they were performing to Jehovah. And the layers of bread are upon the table of pure gold. And there are the golden lampstand and its lamps to light up evening by evening, because we are keeping the obligation to Jehovah our God, but you yourselves have left him. They were performing temple services to Jehovah. And look, with us there is at the head the true God with his priests. And the signal trumpets for sounding the battle alarm against you. O sons of Israel, do not fight against Jehovah the God of your forefathers, for you will not prove successful. And Jeroboam, for his part, dispatched an ambush around to come behind them, so that they proved to be in front of Judah and the ambush behind them. When those of Judah turned around, why, there they had the battle in front and behind, and they began to cry out to Jehovah, while the priests were loudly sounding the trumpets. And the men of Judah, the priests were with the men of Judah, of course, sounding the trumpets. And the men of Judah broke out shouting a war cry, and it came about when the men of Judah shouted a war cry, then the true God himself defeated Jeroboam and all Israel before Abijah and Judah. And the sons of Israel took to flight from before Judah. And then God gave them into their hand, and Abijam and his people went striking them down with a vast slaughter. And the slain of Israel kept falling down, 500,000 chosen men. Thus the sons of Israel were humbled at that time. But the sons of Judah proved superior because they leaned upon Jehovah, the God of their forefathers. And Abijah kept chasing after Jeroboam and got to capture cities from him, Bethel and its dependent towns, and Jeshanah and its dependent towns, and Ephraim and its dependent towns. And Jeroboam did not retain any more power in the days of Abijam. But Jehovah dealt him a blow so that he died. And Abijah continued to strengthen himself. In time, he got 14 wives for himself, and became father to 22 sons and 16 daughters, and the rest of Abijah's affairs, even his ways and his words, are written in the exposition of the prophet Iddo. We don't have today in our possession, the last that I knew of anyway, we don't have the exposition of the prophet Iddo. It's a book or some kind of a document that we are not in possession of, as far as I know, at the current time. Now let's go to Jonah chapter 3. Then the word of Jehovah occurred to Jonah the second time, saying, "Get up, go to Nineveh, the great city, and proclaim to her the proclamation that I'm speaking to you." Now, in Clark's commentary on Jonah chapter 3, he says that according to Diodorus Siculus, the ancient historian, the city of Nineveh was 60 miles in circumference. So that gives you an idea how big it was. Divided by 3, it's about 20 miles across in diameter. That was considered to be 3 days' journey, a walking distance. After that, Jonah got up and went to Nineveh in accord with the word of Jehovah. Now, Nineveh herself proved to be a city great to God, with a walking distance of 3 days. So that distance of 20 miles diameter, evidently, if that's the right number from Diodorus Siculus, of 60 miles circumference, divided by pi to get diameter would be about 60 divided by 3, or 20 miles diameter. If it takes 3 days to walk 20 miles, then that's a walking distance of 3 days. I'm not sure if that's, you know, correct, but the 3 days here is from God's word, so the walking distance of 3 days is what we're most interested in. Finally, Jonah started to enter into the city the walking distance of 1 day, and he kept proclaiming and saying, "Only 40 days more and Nineveh will be overthrown." And the men of Nineveh began to put faith in God, and they proceeded to proclaim a fast and to put on sackcloth, from the greatest one of them even to the least one of them. When the word reached the king of Nineveh, then he rose up from his throne and put off his official garment from himself, and covered himself with sackcloth and sat down in the ashes. This is the king of Nineveh, sat down in the ashes. Furthermore, he had the cry made, and he had it said in Nineveh by the decree of the king and his great one, saying, quote, "No man and no domestic animal, no herd and no flock should taste anything at all. None should take food, even water they should not drink. And let them cover themselves with sackcloth, man and domestic animal, and let them call out to God with strength and come back, each one from his bad way and from the violence that was in their hands. Who is there knowing whether the true God may turn back and actually feel regret and turn back from his burning anger, so that we may not perish?" End quote. The king of Nineveh showed faith in the true God, in other words. And there's a video it's on jw.org, about Jonah. I think we list it. I'm listing it also. Available on the Will of Jehovah homepage, willofjehovah.com. But this video about Jonah, it comes to mind. It's very vivid in my memory. I remember it well. I mean, I remember the way that Jonah spoke when he entered the city in that video. It really stuck with me because it brought it to life in a way that, you know, the mere written words doesn't quite do. You know, it was an reenactment in a film form, or video form, right? With it was marvelous production of sets, or you know, computer graphics or whatever they were using to produce the realistic scenery and everything was so, it was so well done. You really got a sense of it, of what it was like for Jonah. And the true God got to see their works, that they had turned back, this is verse 10, from their bad way. And so the true God felt regret over the calamity. Over the calamity he felt regret that he had spoken of causing to them. And he did not cause it. God felt regret because the people had felt regret, the people of Nineveh, even the king had felt regret about the bad behavior that they had been carrying on formerly. They were a violent nation, a violent city, as part of a violent nation of Assyria. And God had been intending to punish them, but he had a change of heart. Yahweh did, the true God did, and felt regret at this. After Jonah preached and they repented, the city repented. The men of Nineveh repented. They put faith in God, it says in verse 5. Remarkable. A change, like a stunning change to this violent city of Nineveh. And the video, it's worth watching the video. I am going to now say we're done the study. We're done the study, but I'm going to say whatever I need to say at the end here in our last few minutes or seconds that we have. I've been waiting to... it's great because I finally did accomplish what I was trying to do, which was to make a final transaction with my Odyssey vehicle, my automobile, my van, that I was, it was in such a condition that, you know, the electronics are starting to fail and it has a lot of underbody rust on it. So 20 years old, and I finally sold it to the recycling people, the people who pick up the vehicles. They don't have to recycle it if they can find a use for it, I guess, but it's drivable, but I can't anymore drive it because of the electronics problems, and made it more of a problem. Having two cars, I had to change cars every so many months, and it made it a lot of work twice a year to change cars. That was probably the bigger reason. But also, I couldn't trust the car to work for me. That's the thing. Even though it works fine, a lot of warning lights, or several warning lights at all times, you know, indicating systems that aren't working, were there. So that's been done. I'm happy to say it's now the end of our video. It's March 22nd, 2024 of the Common Era. This is Friday. And it's 17:14 hours Eastern Daylight Time now, little children. I'm Ward Green, and I love you very much. And on my behalf, this is Liv Dusty. And this is Cassie saying bye for now.